A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel and Hannah just finished a move between two Jerusalem apartments. The plan was 1 week. They hired a crew for the heavy stuff, but to keep costs down, Daniel did a few days of box hauling himself. The Euro boxes were the hero of the operation. Rigid, stackable, handles on all sides. But they're expensive, so supply ran short, and the rest went into standard cardboard moving boxes. Everything was fine until the very end. Daniel's in decent shape. Just a routine lift of a cardboard box, and his lower back seizes up. Not a disc, not a fracture, just a classic lumbar strain. The kind where you take ibuprofen for a few days and you're back. But here's the thing that stuck with me.
The weight wasn't even that heavy.
He'd been moving heavier Euro boxes all week, with zero issues. Then a half-full cardboard box takes him out at the finish line. And his actual question is, why is the back so brittle? Why is there basically no margin for error? And the harder part, when you're mid-unpack, you can't just put your feet up for 3 days. So what do you actually do?
This is one of those injuries where the standard advice completely falls apart in the real scenario. Every guideline says rest for 24 to 48 hours. The boxes are still sitting in the living room. The kids need plates for breakfast. You're not resting.
It's moving season. July, August. Millions of people are doing exactly this. DIY moves with cardboard boxes, and the injury pattern is utterly predictable. But the part nobody talks about is the recovery constraint. The unpacking doesn't pause because your lumbar spine decided to tap out.
Let's break down what actually happened in that moment, and why a box that wasn't even heavy could do what it did. Because the mechanics here are genuinely surprising, and they explain almost everything about why the back seems so unreasonably fragile.
I want to know why lift number 47 is the one that gets you, when lift number 1 felt exactly the same.
That's the key question, and the answer is not what most people think. It's not that Daniel suddenly forgot how to lift, it's that his back had been quietly losing its protection for hours and he had no way to know it. Here's the paradox that makes the back so maddening. You can deadlift 100 kilos with a barbell. Symmetrical load, bar against your shins, neutral spine, and your lumbar spine handles it fine. The compressive force is high but the shear is low, and your core cylinder is braced. Then you pick up a 12-kilo cardboard box from the floor with your arms extended, and suddenly you're generating over 3,500 newtons of shear force on the L5-S1 disc. That's the joint at the very bottom of your spine, where the lumbar meets the sacrum.
A lighter load is mechanically worse than a heavier one, just because of where it sits relative to your body.
And the numbers are startling. Stuart McGill's lab at Waterloo measured this. The spine buckles under about 5,000 newtons of compression when you're in flexion. A 15-kilo box held at arm's length generates roughly 3,500 newtons of shear at that L5-S1 joint. That gives you a safety factor of about 1.4. Compare that to the knee, which has a safety factor of 4 to 5. The back has almost no redundancy built in.
1.4. So you're operating at 70% of failure, just picking up a moderately loaded box.
That's with fresh tissues. Which brings us to what Daniel actually experienced, because he didn't hurt himself on the first lift. He hurt himself at the end of the day. And that's not a coincidence.
That's what I want to understand. Why does lift 47 fail when lift 1 through 46 were fine?
There's a phenomenon called creep. The passive tissues in your spine, ligaments, fascia, the annulus of the disc, stretch under sustained or repeated flexion. After about 10 minutes of repeated bending and lifting, those tissues lose roughly 30% of their stiffness. They literally elongate and become less effective at resisting force. Meanwhile, the multifidus muscle, the deep stabilizer that runs along your spine, fatigues with each rep. By the time your 40 lifts in, its ability to co-contract and brace the segment is diminished. The threshold for injury has dropped below the load you're applying, and you have no sensation that this is happening. There's no warning light.
The margin was thin to begin with, and then it quietly eroded hour by hour.
Cardboard boxes make this so much worse. Unlike a Euro box with rigid walls and integrated handles, a cardboard box forces you to grip from underneath. Your wrists are flexed, your arms are extended, the box deforms as you lift it, and the center of gravity shifts unpredictably. A study in the journal Ergonomics in 2021 found that lifting cardboard boxes increased lumbar flexion by 18 degrees compared to handled containers of the exact same weight, 18 degrees of additional forward bend. That's enormous when you're already near the buckling threshold.
The box itself is an injury multiplier. It's not just the weight, it's the geometry and the instability.
Which is why I want to be clear about what we're discussing here. Daniel described a lumbar strain, muscle and ligament overstretch. We're not talking about a disc herniation where the nucleus pushes through the annulus, and we're not talking about a fracture. The distinction matters because the recovery protocol for a muscle strain is different from a disc injury. With a strain, you want to maintain movement within tolerance. With certain disc injuries, you might benefit from specific directional exercises like the McKenzie extension protocol. Mixing those up can make things worse.
Daniel's specific constraint. This is what makes the episode different from just Googling back strain recovery, is that he's mid-unpack. The boxes are there. Life doesn't pause. So the standard advice to rest for a day or two isn't just impractical. It's actively unhelpful.
That Cochrane review from 2015 really drove this home. Bed rest for acute low back pain actually worsens outcomes compared to staying active. The multifidus muscle atrophies by about 20% after just 3 days of disuse. So the very muscle you need to protect the spine starts wasting away while you're lying there trying to heal.
We've got three things to answer. One, why the injury margin is razor thin, which we've started to unpack with the shear force numbers and the creep phenomenon. Two, why you can't just rest when you're mid-move. The atrophy data alone starts to explain that. And three, what actually works for recovery when bed rest is off the table? That's where I think the real value is. Because nobody gives you a protocol for I'm injured, but I still have to function.
The protocol exists. It's just not widely known outside of rehab circles. To understand it, though, we need to go deeper into what's actually happening mechanically when that strain occurs. The core cylinder is the term McGill uses. It's not just your abs. It's four structures co-contracting. The transverse abdominis, the deepest abdominal layer that wraps around you like a corset, the multifidus running along the spine, the pelvic floor at the bottom, and the diaphragm at the top. When they fire together, they create intra-abdominal pressure that turns your torso into a pressurized column. That pressure offloads the spine.
It's a hydraulic system, essentially.
And when you lift a Eurobox with handles at your sides, you naturally brace. The box is close to your center of mass, your spine is neutral, the cylinder pressurizes. But a cardboard box from the floor, no handles, so you grip from underneath, wrists flexed, arms extended forward, your center of mass shifts anteriorly. The box is now far from your body. To compensate, you round your back. And the moment your spine flexes forward, that pressurized cylinder depressurizes. The transverse abdominis can't engage effectively in flexion. The multifidus loses its mechanical advantage. The erector spinae and the thoracolumbar fascia are left holding the entire load alone.
They're not designed for that.
They're designed for postural support and controlled extension, not for resisting a levered load at in-range flexion. McGill's work showed that in this position, the erector spinae and fascia experience tensile forces 2 to 3 times what they can handle, even at modest box weights. You're not failing because the weight is heavy. You're failing because the structure that normally shares the load has been taken offline by the position you're forced into.
The cardboard box doesn't just add 18 degrees of flexion. It disables the very system that would protect you from those 18 degrees.
That's the mechanism, and it's why the safety factor of 1.4 I mentioned earlier is actually optimistic. That number assumes the core cylinder is partially engaged. If you're fully rounded, grabbing from underneath the deforming box, the real safety factor might be below 1.0, meaning failure is not a risk, it's a certainty given enough reps.
Which loops back to the creep phenomenon. Each lift stretches the passive tissues a little more. The ligaments and fascia lose that 30% stiffness over 10 minutes of repeated bending. So not only is your active protection, the cylinder, offline, but your passive protection, the ligaments, is degrading in real time.
Here's the thing about creep that most people don't realize. The tissues don't fully recover between lifts unless you give them a meaningful break. A 30-second pause between boxes isn't enough. The collagen fibers and ligaments need several minutes of unloading to recoil. So if Daniel was moving boxes continuously for, say, an hour, those passive tissues were progressively elongating the entire time. By the end, the ligaments at L5-S1 were functionally looser, providing less passive restraint, at the exact moment the multifidus was fatigued and providing less active restraint. Two systems failing simultaneously.
It's a convergence of failures, and none of it is perceptible until the moment it happens.
That's what makes acute lumbar strains so psychologically jarring. You feel fine, you feel fine, you feel fine, and then you don't. There's no gradient of warning. The strain occurs when the combined active and passive stabilization drops below the load threshold, and that crossing point is instantaneous.
Daniel's experience, finishing a week of heavy Eurobox lifting with no problem, then getting taken out by a half-empty cardboard box at the very end, is not bad luck. It's the expected outcome of the physics.
It's entirely predictable once you see the numbers. A 20-kilo deadlift with a barbell held against your shins, neutral spine, braced core, you're looking at roughly 2,000 newtons of shear at L5-S1. Now take a 12-kilo cardboard box, lifted from floor level, arms extended, spine flexed. You're generating around 3,800 newtons of shear, nearly double the force, with 50% less weight. The weight is almost irrelevant. The lever arm is everything.
The advice to lift with your legs, not your back, is true but insufficient. The real advice is, keep the load as close to your spine as physically possible.
Don't use containers that force you into a compromised position before you've even lifted. That ergonomic study didn't just measure the 18 degrees of extra flexion. It also found that the peak lumbar moment, the rotational force acting on the spine, was 40% higher with cardboard boxes than with handled containers. 40% more torque on the same discs, same weight, same person. The container design is arguably the dominant variable.
Which makes me think the entire cardboard moving box industry has been skating by on the fact that nobody connects their back pain to the box design. They blame themselves. I lifted wrong.
The industry has zero incentive to change. Handled boxes cost more to manufacture. Die-cut handles weaken the structural integrity of the cardboard unless you reinforce them, which costs even more. So the default remains a handleless deformable cube that forces a biomechanically terrible lifting pattern. It's a perfect storm of cost optimization and injury externalization.
Now we know why it happened. The harder question is, what do you do when you're in the middle of a move and you can't just stop?
This is where the recovery paradox kicks in. Within hours of that strain, the body initiates a protective muscle spasm, it's called splinting, and it reduces your range of motion by 40 to 60%. The muscles around the injured area lock down to immobilize the segment. Makes intuitive sense, right? Don't move the damaged part.
Except you need to move. The boxes are still there.
The spasm itself becomes a problem. That tightness reduces blood flow to the injured tissue by about 25%, so the very mechanism that's supposed to protect you is also starving the tissue of the oxygen and nutrients it needs to repair. It's a trade-off, immobilization versus perfusion, and in the context of a move, it's a trade-off you can't afford.
The spasm is protective in the short term, but counterproductive if it persists.
Bed rest makes it persist. That Cochrane review from 2015 found that people who rested in bed for acute low back pain had worse functional outcomes than those who stayed active. The multifidus atrophies 20% in 3 days. That's the muscle whose entire job is segmental spinal stability, and you lose a fifth of it just lying there.
Which means the standard advice, rest for 24 to 48 hours, isn't just impractical for someone mid-move. It's actively harmful to the recovery trajectory.
The guideline now is, stay active within pain tolerance, but that's frustratingly vague when your activity is lifting boxes. What does that actually mean? How do you dose the loading so you don't re-injure but also don't atrophy?
This is the part Daniel was really asking about. He can't stop, so what's the protocol?
The closest thing we have comes from research on activity cycling. The pattern that emerges from intradiscal pressure studies is 20 minutes of light activity followed by 5 minutes of decompression. And decompression here means lying supine, on your back, with your knees bent, feet flat on the floor, or on a cushion. That position reduces intradiscal pressure by roughly 60% compared to standing. It unloads the discs completely, allows the passive tissues to recoil from that creep we talked about, and restores some of the stiffness the ligaments lost.
It's not a break in the sense of stop moving. It's a specific position that reverses the mechanical loading.
And the 20-minute window matters. It's short enough that the cumulative fatigue that caused the injury in the first place doesn't have time to build to a dangerous level. You're essentially resetting the clock every 20 minutes. There was a case report. A mover who alternated 20 minutes of unpacking with 5 minutes of supine decompression reported 40% less pain by day, 3 compared to someone who pushed through continuously. Same total work output, radically different pain trajectory.
40% less pain for the same amount of unpacking. That's not trivial.
It's achievable. You set a timer on your phone. 20 minutes, you work. 5 minutes, you lie down with your knees up. It feels absurd in the middle of a move, but the alternative is being non-functional by evening.
What about the ibuprofen? Daniel mentioned he was taking it. Is that actually helping, or is it just masking the problem?
This is where the evidence gets nuanced. Ibuprofen is an NSAID. It blocks cyclooxygenase enzymes, which reduces prostaglandin production, which reduces inflammation and pain. But prostaglandins are also involved in the early stages of tissue repair. They signal satellite cells to proliferate and begin rebuilding damaged muscle fibers. A 2020 meta-analysis in BMJ Sports Medicine found that NSAIDs provide short-term pain relief, no question about that, but they do not improve functional recovery at 7 days compared to acetaminophen or even no medication.
You're trading short-term comfort for potentially slower healing.
The first 48 hours are the critical window. That's when the inflammatory phase of healing is most active, and that's when prostaglandin inhibition has the biggest impact on repair. After 48 hours, the trade-off shifts. The inflammation is less productive, and the pain relief becomes more valuable. So if Daniel needs to function, take the ibuprofen, but don't expect it to speed anything up. It's a management tool, not a recovery accelerator.
That's a useful distinction. Most people think anti-inflammatory equals healing.
The ice versus heat thing is another one where conventional wisdom is backwards. For decades, the RICE protocol, rest, ice, compression, elevation, was gospel for acute injuries. But a 2018 randomized controlled trial specifically on acute lumbar muscle strain found that heat therapy outperformed ice for both pain reduction and mobility improvement. Heat increases blood flow to the area, which counters that spasm-induced ischemia, and it helps the muscles relax. Ice does the opposite. It vasoconstricts, reduces blood flow, and can actually prolong the spasm.
Skip the ice pack. Grab a heating pad.
15 minutes of heat before any lifting session. It increases pain tolerance by about 30% based on thermotherapy research, and it gives you a window of reduced spasm where you can move more safely.
What about the actual mechanics of lifting once you're already injured? You can't just avoid bending entirely.
The priority in the first 72 hours is to avoid flexion-based lifting entirely. No rounding forward. Every lift needs to be a hip hinge. Bend at the knees, keep the box pressed against your chest, spine neutral. If the box is on the floor and you can't squat that low without pain, slide it onto a chair first, then lift from there. The goal is to keep the load as close to your center of mass as physically possible, which we already established is the single biggest variable in shear force. Side lying with a pillow between the knees. It maintains neutral pelvic alignment and prevents the top leg from pulling the pelvis into rotation, which stresses the lumbar spine all night. 8 hours of bad alignment can undo all the decompression work you did during the day.
I want to flag one thing about the McKenzie method, because someone listening is going to think of it. The extension exercises, lying prone and propping up on your elbows, those showed a 50% pain reduction in 5 days in a 2019 trial, but that's for discogenic pain, where the problem is the disc pressing posteriorly. For a pure muscle strain, extension can actually aggravate the spasm by stretching the already damaged muscle fibers.
That's an essential distinction. If Daniel's pain centralizes, meaning it moves from his back toward the midline and decreases in his leg, that suggests a disc component and McKenzie might help. But if it's a localized lumbar strain with no radiating symptoms, extension is likely to make it worse. The spasm is the body splinting the injury and forcing extension fights that splinting directly.
The protocol for the first 72 hours is 20 minutes of work, 5 minutes supine with knees bent, heat before lifting, sleep on your side with a pillow between the knees, and use heat, not ice. That's the core of it. Let's boil this down to 4 things you can actually do, whether you're moving next week or you're in pain right now. Because Daniel's situation is specific, but the principles generalize.
First one is about prevention for anyone who hasn't moved yet. Treat cardboard boxes as hazardous material. I mean that literally. Handle them with the same caution you'd give something you know can injure you, because the biomechanics say it can. Limit each cardboard box to 10 kilos maximum. Not 15, not whatever you can fit. And here's a trick that costs almost nothing. Pre-tape handles using duct tape loops on 2 sides before you fill the box. A loop of duct tape reinforced with a second strip gives you something to grip that keeps your wrist neutral and the box close to your body. It doesn't solve the deformation problem entirely, but it eliminates the underhand grip that forces you into flexion.
You're hacking the box to approximate a Eurobox, basically.
And the third part of that rule, never carry a box you can't hold with both hands pressed against your chest. If you have to extend your arms, the box is too big or too heavy, or both. Split the load.
That's actionable. 10 kilos, duct tape handles, chest carry. What about for Daniel's actual situation? Already injured, mid-unpack.
The 25 pacing rule. This is the one piece of protocol that directly addresses the constraint of not being able to stop. 20 minutes of work, 5 minutes of supine decompression. And supine means on your back, knees bent, feet flat. That position drops intradiscal pressure by roughly 60%. It gives the passive tissues time to recoil from the creep we talked about. The 20-minute cap prevents the cumulative fatigue from crossing the injury threshold again. Set a timer. When it goes off, you stop mid-box if you have to.
It's going to feel ridiculous in the moment. You're surrounded by half-unpacked kitchenware, lying on the floor staring at the ceiling.
The alternative is being unable to walk by dinner. The research on activity cycling is clear. Same total work output, dramatically lower pain trajectory. That case report I mentioned showed 40% less pain at day 3. 40% is the difference between functional and miserable.
Third one. And this contradicts what most people reach for. Skip the ice.
Heating pad or hot water bottle on the lumbar area for 15 minutes before any lifting session. The 2018 randomized trial was decisive on this for acute muscle strain. Heat increases blood flow, reduces spasm, and bumps pain tolerance by about 30%. Ice vasoconstricts, reduces perfusion, and can prolong the spasm. The Rice protocol was never validated for back strains specifically. It got generalized from ankle sprains, and nobody questioned it for decades.
The frozen peas stay in the freezer where they belong.
The fourth one is for next time. If you know a move is coming, and moves always come, the single most protective thing you can do is the McGill Big 3. Curl up, side plank, bird dog. Perform daily for 2 weeks before the move. A 2023 study tracked workers who did this protocol and found a 60% reduction in acute low back injury incidents. That's not marginal. That's the difference between finishing the move and being the person we're talking about right now.
The Big 3 specifically target the core cylinder we discussed. The curl up trains the transverse abdominis without flexing the lumbar spine. The side plank builds quadratus lumborum and lateral stabilizers. The bird dog trains the multifidus and the posterior chain in coordination. It's not a general fitness recommendation. It's a targeted intervention for exactly the failure mode we've been describing.
2 weeks is the minimum effective dose. The adaptations are neuromuscular. You're training the co-contraction pattern, not building muscle mass. The brain learns to recruit the stabilizers automatically before you lift. That's what gives you the 60% protection.
Where does this leave us? Daniel's back is recovering. The boxes will eventually get unpacked. But the thing I keep circling back to is the box itself. The Eurobox solved the handling problem completely. Rigid walls, integrated handles, stackable, the whole thing. But it created a supply constraint because they're expensive. So the fallback is the same cardboard box we've been using since what? The 1940s. And it's biomechanically terrible.
The cost difference is the bottleneck. A standard cardboard moving box runs maybe $2 or $3. A Eurobox is $15 to $20 per unit, and you need dozens of them. The math pushes almost everyone toward cardboard for at least part of the load.
Here's the open question. What would a cardboard box 2.0 look like? Something that costs roughly the same to manufacture, but includes integrated handles and maybe a rigid base panel to prevent that deformation mid-lift. Is there a market innovation sitting there that nobody's bothered to pursue because the injury is externalized? The box maker doesn't pay for your lumbar strain.
Die-cut handles with a folded reinforcement flap would add maybe 15 cents per unit in production cost. A corrugated plastic base insert, another 20 cents. You're still under $4 a box, and you've eliminated most of the biomechanical hazard. The technology exists. The will doesn't, because nobody connects the injury to the product.
The injury burden is about to get a lot bigger. Moving costs in the US rose 22% year over year in 2025. More people are doing DIY moves as a result. More untrained people, more cardboard boxes, more cumulative fatigue injuries on day three of a move they couldn't afford to hire out in the first place.
I think we're going to see a wave of research on what you might call consumer ergonomics, designing packaging and moving supplies for people who have zero training in lifting mechanics. The industrial ergonomics literature is robust, but it assumes trained workers in controlled environments. The weekend mover with a U-Haul and 50 cardboard boxes is a completely different population, and almost nobody is studying them.
Which is strange, because the injury numbers have to be enormous. Every emergency department sees a spike in acute low back pain during summer moving season. It's utterly predictable, utterly preventable, and utterly unstudied at the population level.
The back's fragility is a design trade-off we all live with. We traded robustness for mobility. The human spine gives us rotational range and flexion that no other primate has, but the cost is that razor-thin safety factor, 1.4. Understanding the trade-off doesn't make your back stronger, but it tells you where the limits actually are, and most people are operating well outside them without knowing it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, explorers in Eritrea discovered a lava tube ecosystem where a species of blind cave cricket had evolved to feed exclusively on bat guano, an unintended consequence of volcanic geology creating an isolated food web that persisted for thousands of years with no sunlight input.
Soak a you, right?
This has been my weird prompts. If you got a weird prompt about a specific injury, a tool that failed you, or a life hack that didn't work, email the show@myweirdprompts.com. We're on Spotify and wherever else you listen. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Don't lift with a rounded back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.